Chapter 17.
No, you can't! You can't!
Darren shouted in his sleep, lost in a vivid dream.
I am king now! I am king!
He was running, running for his life, over rocky terrain, no cover but for a dense fog that clung to the ground. His lungs burned, the muscles in his legs screamed from overuse, and with each breath that escaped his lips, he whimpered like a frightened child. Suddenly, in the distance, he heard the royal dogs barking. He heard the huntsman's horn blaring.
No!
Cried Darren, his throat on fire. He tossed a fearful glance over his shoulder and saw the tracking party in the distance.
Dearest gods, no!
He pushed on, his entire frame rebelling and crying out for rest. Each labored stride claimed a bit more of his strength, a bit more of his courage, until at last he stumbled and went crashing to the ground. He lay panting, shuddering, a coward exposed, and then the dogs were upon him. They tore at him, at his clothing, at his flesh. A syrupy wetness filled his mouth, and he knew he was drowning in his own blood. At length he heard a voice from somewhere in the distance, somewhere through the pain. The dogs released him, whimpered, and retreated, and Bryan stood over him, the crown of Bandadon on his head.
No!
Bellowed Darren, bolting upright in his bed. He glanced about and saw only darkness.
A light! I must have light!
Aye, your grace,
came a frightened voice, and there was movement beside him.
Quickly!
Why is the fire out? He heard the scratch of a flint, saw a brilliant spark, another, and soon a meager fire was crackling on the hearth. Still fearful, he watched a silhouette cross the room, holding a lit taper, and a moment later a candle glowed beside his bed.
I told you not to let the fire go out.
Before him, completely naked, stood the kitchen girl he'd seduced earlier that evening, her raven-black tresses cascading to her shoulders, her full round breasts illuminated by the candlelight.
I'm sorry, your grace. You've such a comfortable bed. I fell asleep.
Shivering, Darren pulled the blanket up to his neck. Since his brother's escape, he had slept fitfully, plagued with bad dreams.
I'm not partial to the dark. He realized she was staring at him.
I find the fire comforting. His grace had a bad dream.
Darren said nothing.
Shall I leave now, your grace?
He gazed at her. She was lovely, quite lovely. So firm in all the right places, so soft in all the rest, and, if truth be told, he rather liked how she smelled of onions and fried pork fat.
No, I'm in need of company.
Return to bed. The girl slid under the blanket and pressed herself against him. Shadows from the flickering hearth fire danced across her face. The height of her cheekbones, the angle of her nose, most everything about her reminded him of Mian, except, of course, the color of her hair. His breathing deepened and his heart quickened in pace. But before he had even touched her, the dream was back in his head, and even though he knew what was coming, it had the same effect. Running, running, growling, chewing, biting, crying, brother, crown.
Is there something wrong, your grace?
Darren surfaced from his thoughts.
What?
Something wrong, your grace.
You've lost your vigor and you're very sweaty.
Sweaty? He ran his hand along his chest. True enough, he was sopping wet. The girl raised herself onto her elbows.
It's all right, your grace. What with you being king and all, I imagine you've a lot on your mind and twice that much to do.
He was eager now for her to leave. You are very astute, my dear. So, if you will excuse my rudeness, I will say good night. She gathered her things and went to the door, where she paused to slip into her kirtle.
We've some tasty roast pig and onions downstairs. Would you like me to bring you some?
No, he replied, and nothing more.
Made it myself,
said the girl, giving him a smile. Thank you. Perhaps later. He did not look at her again until she was closing the door. Alone now, he dragged himself from the bed and put on a robe. He drifted to the embrasure and stared at the dark clouds that had collected in the sky.
He was still sweating, and at the same time he had chills. He glanced at his hands and saw they were trembling.
"Take hold of yourself, man," thought Darren.
"You have nothing to fear. It matters not that what's-his-name has escaped. Let him gather his friends. Let him rally whom he pleases. It is too late. You are king now. You are the one who wears the crown."
He let the words sink in a moment. They seemed to brace him.
"You have gathered more wealth in just a few months' time than father or grandfather did in their combined lifetimes. There is no one in all the United Kingdoms powerful enough to oppose you."
Feeling more confident now, he turned to the bed, only to find Brian lying casually upon it, a broad smile on his face.
"Hello, brother," said his twin with a flippant wave.
"I hope the dogs haven't chewed on you too much." He snapped his fingers, and three dogs, all foaming at the mouth, hopped onto the bed and growled viciously at him.
Startled, Darren stumbled backwards, covering his face with his hands as he cried,
"You are not there! You are not there! You are only my mind playing devilish tricks on me!"
He chanced a look. Sure enough, the bed was empty. He whirled about, expecting Brian to be somewhere else in the room, by the door to his outer apartment, by the hearth, by the archway framing the balcony. He hurried there, thinking Brian might be outside, but no, the balcony was empty. He heard a low rumble and realized it was raining. Across from him, upon the battlements, he saw a sentry shivering, his head bent low against the wet wind. As a boy, he had loved days like this. They kept the men and women of the court captive inside the castle, and that meant he could terrorize more people with his tricks. Oh, how he wished he could turn back time. But as that was something not even a king could achieve, he sighed aloud, hopped back into bed, and pulled the blankets over his head. King Jasper stood outside his campaign tent under a canvas awning, listening to the rap-tapping of the rain. His wife and daughter were inside, preparing themselves for their third night's sleep on a journey that would not end until they had reached Jasperland. He calculated the trip would take 3 weeks. The rain had slowed his progress some, but he had compensated for inclement weather in his figuring. No matter how well prepared, there were still some things about first-class travel one was forced to leave to chance. The king surveyed his encampment. Horses tethered, tents pitched, wagons clustered, sentries posted, fires hissing and smoking. All was well.
"Well,"
he thought, admitting the truth.
"All is not well.
Would that Mian was with me,"
the king reflected. Images from the past flooded his brain. Mian still a toddler. Mian a young princess. Mian his confidant and hunting companion.
"Such a sharp mind,"
he thought.
"How could she suddenly have become so witless?
Was her love so blinding she could not see the king for what he was?"
"A madman,"
came his answer.
"Worse than that, a despot."
For a madman alone could be pitied and then restrained. But a despot, a mad despot at that, was dangerous, unpredictable, and vindictive.
"Is everything well, my lord?"
asked Jonna, curious. Realizing he had been observed, the king scoffed and cleared his throat.
"Ach, aye, damn wood smoke burns my eyes."
He wiped the tear that had run down his cheek. A stout man, a powerful man, a warrior feared in battle by his troops and his enemies alike. But when it came to his daughters, King Jasper was as tender-hearted as a blubbering troubadour.
"Go back inside, lass."
"Would you like something, my lord? Some tea, perhaps? I made a pot earlier for my lady. It might help you sleep."
"No, but I thank you. I'll be in shortly."
"Very well, my lord."
"Oh, and Jonna, I understand your anxiety being separated from Mian like this, but you needn't sleep at my feet."
"Aye, my lord,"
said Jonna before disappearing inside. His thoughts turned once more to the past. He had ridden by Ordenaut's side for 20 years, watched him forge an empire, served as his most trusted advisor.
How could such a decent, hard-working man of noble character produce such a worthless wretch? Two worthless wretches, in fact. Why had the gods been so cruel?
The answer lay beyond his reason, and would forever remain a mystery to him. He sighed and gazed at the heavens where he assumed Ordenaut's spirit resided.
"Perhaps it's best ye ne'er lived long enough to see the fruits of your loins turned overripe and stench-ridden."
A man like King Jasper did not mince words, not when addressing his friends, not even when addressing his dead friends.
"As for me, I did what I could. I hope you're not cross with me for taking leave of your daft son's court."
His thoughts turned to the empire.
Bandidon, Jasperland, the other United Kingdoms of the Council. What would happen now that he was gone? How long would order last without true leadership? How long before the old days were no longer the old days, but new days that seemed like the old days? Sooner or later there would be a dispute, a raid, a battle, a war. King Jasper shook his head. All that work for nothing, he thought. Angry now, he gripped the hilt of his sword. It was like gripping the hand of a trusted friend, one that had seen him through many a battle and had saved his life countless times.
Slaybest was its name. It had been in his family since the first swordmaker moulded the blade from the armour of the war god Gunnakilja. Forged in the flames of the underworld, cooled in the frosty heights of the heavenly halls, inlaid with the gems from a dragon's belly, and enchanted by a wizard of the highest order named Thaumaturge. It was a proud sword, a noble weapon. It was also very sharp.
Ah, blasted fool,
Jasper sighed aloud. He'll be the ruin of the modern world.
Oh, dearest. The king pivoted his bulky frame and found the Lady Ainoya by the tent opening, holding the flap across the bodice of her nightgown. He scowled and looked her straight in the eye, the right eye, for it was the one fixed on him. He pursed his lips and made ready to speak Brian's name, but then Jasper paused, struck by a new thought. Had he made the right decision by deserting the court? Having done so, who was left to oppose the tyrant? Certainly none of the other kings was as strong. In that moment he knew he had made the wrong choice, allowed his personal feelings to cloud his judgment.
Who, dear, who is the blasted fool? Asked Ainoya, eyeing him more carefully.
Why, me, of course, said Jasper.
Though angry with himself, he stepped to her and brushed a down-like feather from her shoulder.
You're not molten already, are you?
She snorted in amusement.
No, dear, it's the quilt. Now come to bed.
No time for that, said the king, placing the back of his hand gently against her cheek. We must go back.
What?
Get dressed, woman.
We make for the capital. Ainoya's eyes darted this way and that.
But we just came from there.
Hearing the distress in the queen's voice, Blindella appeared in the entrance and stepped to her mother's side.
What's wrong?
We're going back,
the queen fretted.
What?
Blindella turned her good eye upon her father. She had suffered much angst and embarrassment over the past few months. Her betrothal to Prince Darren had not gone smoothly even before he had turned assassin. And now that he was rotting in the king's dungeon for the rest of his life, the chances of her getting to know him better seemed next to nil, if not more remote.
But father, I don't see why.
Of course you don't, but that's not your fault.
Jasper, pleaded his wife,
it's the middle of the night.
Night, day, it does not matter. The sooner we get there, the better. Jonna, where'd you run off to, lass?
Jonna poked her head in between the two royals.
Here, your grace.
Get the queen and the princess dressed. We're breaking camp.
He did not wait for her to reply, but turned and stepped into the rain.
Where's my captain of the guard? Angus, roust yourself. Here, my lord,
said Angus, bursting from the tent to the king's right. His hair was tousled and his tunic was crooked. He held his sword belt in his hands.
Assemble the men. Break camp.
Now, my lord.
Am I speaking gibberish? I know, and be quick about it.
Before Angus could shout an order, a great commotion was heard on the far side of the camp. Out of the darkness came men on horseback, helmeted, dressed for battle, wearing the colours of the Bandidonian Guard. Harsh cries rose up, horses whinnied, and under all was the sound of steel clashing in the distance. King Jasper stood agape, not knowing what to make of the intrusion. He recognized the man at the head of the column as the Duke of Cunningham's henchman.
Mortimer, is that you?
Aye, your grace,
called the man.
Why have you come? What is happening here?
Mortimer halted his detachment and dismounted. In his hand, he held a scythe-shaped blade with a crudely fashioned wooden handle. Jasper had seen its like before, during the wars with the mad Highlanders.
What have you there? A cut in two?
Right again, your grace,
said the henchman, approaching him quickly.
And I'm happy to say we arrived just in time.
Jasper gave him a stony look.
In time for what?
Mortimer glanced at the king and then at Angus beside him.
Will he bullies, Your Grace, raiding the countryside.
Despite the women's gasps, Jasper held his ground.
Woolly bullies? This far south? Aye, Your Grace.
He thrust the cut into deep into Angus's chest, just below the man's ribs. Angus gasped, died, and slid off the henchman's blade.
Oh, and by the way,
said Mortimer, smiling,
I believe you are under attack.
Exhausted from weeping, Mian sat upon the floor at the center of the North Tower chamber, resting against a long pine box. A week had come and gone since Darren had imprisoned her, a week without contact with another human being. At first, she thought she would be missed, that someone would come looking for her, but no one had. She still wore the riding shirt and leggings she had donned the night of the feast, but they no longer smelled very fresh nor looked very crisp. Her hair hung in tangled mats to her shoulders and had that unwashed odor she despised. When first she had entered the tower, she beheld a stark room save for a few pieces of ornately carved furniture, a four-post bed, and the pine box. The Queen Mother, however, was nowhere to be found. Though the room was only 12 by 12, with nothing unexposed, Mian looked about, wondering where she was. She even checked under the bed.
The Queen had exhibited some odd behavior since her husband's death.
But she was not there either. It then occurred to her the gods had locked her in the wrong tower. Dearest gods, thought the princess, panicky, am I to be confined here by myself, without even the Queen Mother to talk to? What will I do? How will I pass the endless hours? Surely the silence will drive me mad. She was about to despair when suddenly she remembered something her tutor had said the day they departed for Bandadon. Dignity, Your Highness, is a princess's taskmaster. Without it, she is no better than a common milkmaid. And composure. Composure is just as important, perhaps even more so, depending on the circumstances. Keep them both ever in your mind, for at times they are a lady's only defense, nay, her only weapon against those that would see her compromised. Here the woman had paused, a far-off look in her eyes as she twisted the wedding band on her finger. When next she spoke, there was a different tone in her voice, one that was distant and, perhaps, vindictive. Aye, her only weapon. So heed me when I say be careful with your intended. Make sure he knows just who is master in the bedroom. Oh, he'll ply you at first with flowers and treats, but when those do not work, he'll berate you with curses, then cry and beseech you upon his knees. But don't you weaken, no matter how much he begs. Let him go back to that little kitchen slut he's been diddling. Let him slither between her legs. It was here she had paused and taken a deep, calming breath, and when next she had spoken, she was her old self again. Remember that always, my dear. Dignity and composure, and you can weather any crisis. Though she had found her tutor's words somewhat unsettling, Mian understood their gist. But all her training, all her strength, had not prepared her for isolation such as this. She wanted desperately to be reunited with her family, her father in particular. Arguing with him had left her feelings bruised and her spirits dismal. They were so much alike, she was sure he was feeling much the same way. Despite the rift between them, she continued to see him as her protector. She drifted back to a different time, when she was a little girl, and he would sit beside her bed at night, sword in hand, ready to fight off any trolls that might steal into her room and attempt to kidnap her.
This was, I should mention, a real threat, and not the wild imaginings of a frightened little girl. There had been much rain that year, and trolls, like mosquitoes, proliferated abundantly whenever there was stagnant water about.
But this was no consolation to her, for she knew her father was well away, possibly even halfway to Jasperland by now. Even if she succeeded in getting word to him, it would take months before he could muster an army and lay siege to the castle. Mian chewed on her lower lip, racking her brain for a possible solution.
Think,
she told herself, there must be someone who can help you. But this proved to be fruitless. Apart from the royal family and a few of Brian's friends, there had been no time to meet anyone else. Realizing just how alone she was, Mian began to tremble.
Stay strong, she insisted. Stay strong. You are a descendant of the ancient Sitipati.
Think of your mother. Was she not once called Ainoia Featherous Unsis, the winged one? But even as she formed the words, tears sprang to her eyes. Everywhere she looked, she saw dark, cold stone. And knowing she was trapped inside the chamber and subject to Darren's whims, her courage fled like a routed army. She fell upon the pine box and buried her face in the crook of her arm. And there she stayed, weeping uncontrollably. She awoke with a start. For a moment, she did not know where she was, until she looked down and saw she had fallen asleep upon the pine box. Everything was the same, except the light. The room was dimmer now. There was something else as well, a steady swishing sound that came from outside. She stood and approached the narrow embrasure, the room's one and only source of light. Peering outside, she saw the sky was choked with clouds. Rain was pouring down in torrents. A gloomy day, she thought, one befitting my mood. She watched the rain as it struck the small section of battlement visible to her. A large puddle had collected on the wall's walk, whose surface was kept in constant turmoil by the heavy downpour. She was watching this for a while when a sentry, his head bowed and shoulders hunched against the rain, stepped into her line of sight. She sucked in her breath, so excited was she to see another human being. "Hello down there," called Mian, squeezing into the stone casement. The soldier stopped and glanced about. "Up here," called the princess again, but he did not think to look in her direction. Frustrated, the princess wriggled free and searched about for something to throw at him. Her eyes fell upon a piece of juicy fruit that she had not eaten for breakfast that morning. Scooping it up, she returned to the embrasure. But by the time she had once again jammed herself into the casement, the sentry was no longer in sight. Disgruntled, she let the fruit fly anyway, only to be further piqued when it landed short of the battlement, hitting a merlon and falling out of sight. She pulled herself inside and wiped her scowling face on her sleeve. Of all the cursed luck, her mood now sullen and peevish, she plopped upon the bed. She stared about the room, her jail, hating it more than ever. She studied the sparse appointments. Whoever decorated this place should have been drawn and quartered, thought the princess. Apart from the stand at the side of her bed and the drop-leaf table by the room's embrasure, there was naught else but two straight-backed chairs in all the chamber. "Oh, such lavishness," brooded Mian, feeling most sarcastic at that moment. But then, peering at the pine box, she realized she had forgotten to include it. "How foolish of me," said the princess, pretending to chide herself. "Obviously, it was intended to tie together the entire decor. Just the other day, I was thinking I should buy a pine box. And this one, well, this one is of rare distinction." She took it in with her eyes. Strange, thought Mian, that it should be here, sitting by itself in the middle of the floor. The longer she stared at it, the more out of place it seemed. Having nothing better to do, she decided to examine it. Placing heel to toe, she walked around the box, determining its dimensions to be about 6 feet long and 3 feet wide. It appeared to be recently assembled and smelled of fresh-cut pine wood. So recently, in fact, it still dripped sap in places. She walked around it once more, pausing here and there to tap it with her foot. She reversed direction, then knelt and rapped on the lid in several locations. The sound came back differently each time, and from this she determined there was something inside. She tried to lift the box. She failed. There was definitely something inside, and it was heavy. She examined its construction, noting how the lid had been nailed into place all along the perimeter of the box. "If only I had something to pry it open," whispered Mian aloud. She glanced about the room, but found nothing that would serve as a tool. Sighing deeply, she went to her bed, where she sat and rested her head against a bedpost and stared at the box intently. At length, the light dwindled within the room. Her dinner tray was slid beneath her door, yet she let it sit there untouched out of spite, for each time a meal was delivered in this manner, it rankled her. Initially, she had decided to starve herself to death, and by doing so protest her mistreatment, but she had quickly relented, thinking it more important to maintain her strength in the event she discovered a means of escape. One thing about which she could not complain, the fare was tasty and abundant. There was a mutton joint as big as a mallet and some capon wings, a large bowl of bread pudding, half a wheel of cheese, fruit, and a short pitcher of wine. It was a meal large enough to sustain her for at least 3 days. Yet in the morning, another tray would be slid beneath her door, and it too would be overflowing with food. She lit a candle, and once seated, served herself some bread pudding with the silver spoon upon the tray. She had eaten only a few mouthfuls when it dawned on her she could use the utensil to pry open the box. Licking it clean, she knelt and applied it to the top seam. The spoon bent. This did not discourage her. Turning it around, she used the tip of the handle and worked it back and forth until she had created a tiny gap. Encouraged, she repeated the process along the entire perimeter. She rested a moment, her back tight from bending over, her hands aching. When she looked up at the candle, she was surprised to find it half as tall. She rose stiffly and poured herself some wine. The drink was warm and bracing, and, feeling renewed in both strength and spirit, she went back to work and did not stop again until the gap was wide enough to slip her fingers inside. By this time, the skin on her hands was cracked and bleeding in places. Her knees were raw, and the muscles in her shoulders burned like a firestorm out of control. Yet she was too close now to allow pain to stop her. She had to know what the box contained. She brought her eyes just an inch away from the slit, but still could see nothing. She shoved her hand through the gap, as far as it would go, felt something soft and pliable, and pulled out some wood shavings. Oh no, thought Mian, dismayed. All that work for nothing. But wait, this box is far too heavy to contain just shavings. There must be something else inside, something underneath. She worked long into the night, until at last the lid was a good yank away from coming off. She struggled to her feet and stretched the kinks from her muscles. Then, with her remaining strength, she gripped the edge and pulled. The lid groaned. She groaned. And before she could recover, Mian found herself sailing backwards, landing on the floor with a loud thud.
Oh, this better be worth all the trouble, said the princess from where she lay.
She raised herself onto her elbows and looked. To her relief, the lid was lying on the floor, and the box waiting to be examined. She scrambled to it on hands and knees, too excited now to care about her sore muscles. She reached for the candle and held it aloft, then dug her free hand into the shavings and shoveled them aside. Not long thereafter, she discovered the toes of two soft leather slippers embroidered with gold thread. How odd, said Mian aloud, her brow furrowing. Why would someone want to crate these up? They are far too well crafted and look most fashionable. There was something vaguely familiar about them, too. She had seen them just recently, though she could not remember who had worn them. She dug away more shavings, heedlessly spilling them onto the floor. She cared little about the mess she was making. For the first time in days, she had something to do and something to think about other than her incarceration. I wonder if the owner will mind my wearing them, she thought to herself. Oh, I hope they fit. I'm dying to get out of these boots. She dug past the tongues, feeling something cold and smooth to the touch. And when she brushed more shavings aside, she discovered the shoes were far from empty. She gasped, almost dropping the candle, and scrambled away from the box. No, 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 it can't be, she thought, cringing, mortified. Those slippers are filled with feet. For a long time, she sat by the wall, staring at the box, fighting her fears and revulsion. Dearest gods, that thing's a coffin. A coffin! I'm sharing my cell with a dead person. She scrambled for the lid, intending to seal the box shut. She removed her boot, thinking to use its heel as a makeshift hammer, and was ready to begin pounding when a sudden thought struck her. Now wait, said Mian to herself, pausing to consider. All those hours you spent trying to open it. It seems such a waste to seal it up before you've taken a decent look. After all, whoever is in there is already dead. It seems highly unlikely they would mind. It was then her conscience chided her. What is wrong with you? Seal it up and be done with it, before you are changed by this forever. Do you want people to think you're a ghoul or some evil agent? But despite the grisliness of the situation, the princess's curiosity was far too imposing. In a moment, she had set aside the lid. She took a deep breath. Then, grabbing the candle, went to the other end of the box. She knelt, and with the greatest delicacy, picked off the shavings a piece at a time. First, the tip of the nose appeared, the bridge, the brows, the forehead, and widow's peak. Who is this? She thought, perplexed. She brushed more shavings aside, exposing the eyelids, the cheeks, the lips, and then the chin. By now, the meager light in the room had grown quite dim. A long shadow stretched across the box, obscuring the face below her. She brought the candle closer, and it was then, in the flickering light, she finally had the answer to her questions. All her questions. Her mouth fell open and she sucked in a breath. Her eyes went wide with terror. "Dearest gods," she heard herself say. "Dearest gods in the heavens, it cannot be. Even he would not sink to such a depth." But by then, the seams of her reason were tearing apart. The room, the castle, the kingdom, all had shifted and were spinning out of control. "Dearest gods," cried Mian aloud, dropping the candle and retreating to the corner of the room. "He's killed his own mother. He's killed the queen."